truckloads, or rail cars, to learn about gelatin PR. Our replicant human thigh was cooked up by Rick Loden, a freewheeling materials engineer whose area of expertise is bullets. Loden works at the Department of Energy's Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. The lab is best known for its plutonium work in the Manhattan atomic bomb development project, and now covers a far broader and generally less unpopular range of projects. Loden, for instance, has lately been involved in the design of an environmentally friendly, no-lead bullet that doesn't cost the military an arm and a leg to clean up after. Loden loves guns, loves to talk about them. Right now, he's trying to talk about them with me, a distinctly trying experience, for I keep shepherding the conversation back to dead bodies, which Loden clearly doesn't enjoy very much. You would think that a man who felt comfortable extolling the virtues of hollow-point bullets, expands to twice its size and just thumps that person, would be okay talking about dead bodies, but apparently not. "You just cringe," he said when I mentioned the prospect of shooting into human cadaver tissue. Then he made a noise that I transcribed in my notes as, "Olg." We're standing under a canopy at the Oak Ridge shooting range, about to set up the first stopping power test. The thighs sit in an open plastic cooler at our feet, sweating mildly. They are consommé-colored, and owing to the cinnamon added to mask the material's mild rendering plant effluvium, smell like big red chewing gum. Rick carries the cooler out to the target table 30 feet away and settles an ersatz thigh into the gel cradle. I make conversation with Scotty Dowdle, who is supervising the shooting range today. He is telling me about the pine beetle epidemic in the area. I point to a stand of dead conifers in the woods a quarter mile back behind the target. "Like over there?" Scotty says no. He says they died of bullet wounds, something I never knew pine trees could do. Rick returns and sets up the gun, which isn't really a gun but a universal receiver, a tabletop gun housing that can be outfitted with barrels of different calibers. Once it's aimed, you pull a wire to release the bullet. We're testing a couple of new bullets that claim to be frangible, meaning they break apart on impact. The frangible bullet was designed to solve the over-penetration or ricochet problem, i.e. bullets passing through victims, bouncing off walls and harming bystanders, or the police, or soldiers who fired them. The side effect of the bullets breaking apart on impact is that it tends to do this inside your body if you're hit. In other words, it tends to have really, really good stopping power. It basically functions like a tiny bomb inside the victim, and is therefore, to date, mainly reserved for special response, SWAT-type activities, such as hostage rescue. Rick hands me the trigger string and counts down from three. The gelatin sits on the table, soaking up the sunshine, basking beneath the calm blue Tennessee skies. Tra-la-la, life is gay, it's good to be a gelatin block, Blam! The block flips up into the air, off the table and onto the grass. As John Wayne said, or would have, had he had the opportunity, "This block of gelatin won't be bothering anyone anytime soon." Rick picks up the block and places it back in its cradle. You can see the bullet's journey through the thigh. Rather than over-penetrating and exiting the backside, the bullet has stopped short several inches into the block. Rick points to the stretch cavity. Look at that, a total dump of energy, total incapacitation. I had asked Loden whether munitions professionals ever concern themselves, as did Cohier and Lagarde, with trying to design bullets that will incapacitate without maiming or killing. Loden's face displayed the sort of look it displayed earlier when I'd said that armor-piercing bullets were cute. He answered that the military chooses weapons more or less by how much damage they can inflict on a target, whether the target be a human or a vehicle. This is another reason ballistic gelatin tends to get used in stopping power tests, rather than cadavers. We're not talking about research that will help mankind save lives. We're talking about research that will help mankind take lives. I suppose you could argue that policemen's and soldiers' lives may be saved, but only by taking someone else's life first. Anyway, it's not a use of human tissue for which you're likely to get broad public support. Of course, the other big reason munitions people shoot ballistic gelatin is reproducibility. Provided you follow the recipe, it's always the same. Cadaver thighs vary in density and thickness according to the age, gender, and physical condition of their owners when they stopped using them. Still another reason, Cleanup's a breeze. The remains of this morning's thighs have been picked up and repacked in the cooler, a tidy, bloodless mass grave of low-calorie dessert. Not that a ballistic gelatin shootout is completely devoid of gore. Loden points to the toe of my sneaker at a Pulp Fiction fleck of spatter. You got some simulant on your shoe. Rick Loden never shot a dead man, though he had his chance. He was working on a project in cooperation with the University of Tennessee's Human Decay Facility, aimed at developing bullets that would resist corrosion from the acid breakdown products inside a dead body and help forensics types solve crimes long after they happen. Rather than shooting the experimental bullets into his cadavers, Loden got down on his hands and knees with a scalpel and a pair of tweezers and surgically placed them. He explained that he did this because he wanted the bullets to end up in specific places: muscle, fatty tissue, the head and chest cavities, the abdomen. If he chopped them into the tissue, they might have overpenetrated, as they say, and wound up in the dirt. He also did it that way because he felt he had to. It was always my impression that we couldn't shoot a body. He recalls another project, one in which he was developing a simulated human bone that could be put inside blocks of ballistic gelatin, much as banana and pineapple chunks are floated inside Jell-O. To calibrate the simulated bone, he needed to shoot some actual bone and compare the two. I was offered 16 cadaver legs to shoot at. DOE told me they would terminate my project if I did that. We had to shoot pig femurs instead. Loden told me that military munitions professionals even worry about the politics of shooting into freshly killed livestock. A lot of guys won't do that. They'll go get a ham from the store or a leg from the slaughterhouse. Even then, a lot of them don't openly publish what they do. There's still a stigma. 10 feet behind us, sniffing the air, is a groundhog who has made unfortunate real estate choices in his life. The animal is half the size of a human thigh. "If you shot that groundhog with one of these bullets," I say to Rick, "what would happen? Would it completely vaporize?" Rick and Scotty exchange a look. I get the feeling that the stigma attached to shooting groundhogs is fairly minimal. Scotty shuts the ammo case. "Create a lot of paperwork is what would happen." Only recently has the military dipped its toes back into the roiling waters of publicly funded cadaveric ballistics research. As one would imagine, the goals are strictly humanitarian. At the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology's Ballistic Missile Trauma Research Lab last year, Commander Marlene DeMaio dressed cadavers in a newly developed body armor vest and fired a range of modern-day munitions at their chests. The idea was to test the manufacturer's claims before outfitting the troops. Apparently, body armor manufacturers' effectiveness claims aren't always to be trusted. According to Lester Rohn, chief engineer at the Independent Ballistics and Body Armor Test Facility, H.P. White Labs, the companies don't do cadaver tests. H.P. White doesn't either. "Anybody looking at it coldly and logically shouldn't have any problem with it," said Rohn. "It's dead meat, but for some reason it's just something that has been politically incorrect from before there was a term for politically correct." DeMaio's cadaver tests represent a distinct improvement over how vests were originally tested by the military. In Operation Boar, during the Korean War, the Doran vest was tested simply by giving it to 6,000 soldiers and seeing how they fared compared to soldiers wearing standard vests. Rohn says he once watched a video made by a Central American police department that tested their vests by having officers put them on and then shooting at them. The trick to designing body armor is to make it thick and unyielding enough to stop bullets without making it so heavy and hot and uncomfortable that officers won't wear it. What you don't want is what the Gilbertese Islanders used to have. While I was in D.C. to see DeMaio, I stopped at the Smithsonian's Museum of Natural History, where I saw a display of body armor from the Gilbert Islands. Battles in Micronesia were so pitched and bloody that Gilbertese warriors would outfit themselves head to foot with doormat-thick armor fashioned from the twisted fibers of coconut hulls. On top of the significant humiliation of making one's entrance onto the battlefield looking like an enormous macrame planter was the fact that the armor was so bulky it required the assistance of several squires to help maneuver you. As with automotive cadavers, DeMaio's body armor bodies were instrumented with accelerometers and load cells, in this case on the sternum, to record the impact forces and give researchers a detailed medical rendering of what was happening to the chest inside the armor. With some of the nastier caliber weapons, the cadavers sustained lung lacerations and rib fractures, but nothing that translated into an injury that, if you weren't already a cadaver, could kill you. More tests are planned with the goal of making a test dummy along the lines of those used by the automotive industry, so that one day cadavers won't be needed. Because she had proposed to use human cadavers, DeMaio was advised to proceed with extreme caution. She gathered the blessings of 3 institutional review boards, a military legal counsel, and a card-carrying ethicist. The project was ultimately approved with one stipulation: no penetration. The bullets had to stop short of the cadaver's skin. Did DeMaio roll her eyes in exasperation? She says not. When I was in medical school, I used to think, come on, don't be irrational. They've expired. They've donated their bodies, you know? When I got into this project, I realized that we are a part of the public trust, and even if it doesn't make scientific sense, we have to be responsive to people's emotional concerns. On an institutional level, the caution comes from fear of liability and of unpleasant media reports and withdrawal of funding. I spoke with Colonel John Baker, the legal counsel from one of the institutions that sponsored DeMaio's research. The head of this institution preferred that I refrain from naming it and instead refer to it as simply a federal institution in Washington. He told me that over the past 20-some years, Democratic congressmen and budget-minded legislators have tried to close the place down, as have Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, and People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I got the feeling that my request for an interview had brought this man's day crashing down like so many pine trees behind a DOE shooting range. The concern is that some survivor will be so taken aback that they'll bring suit, said Colonel Baker from his desk at a federal institution in Washington. And there is no body of law in this area, nothing you can look to other than good judgment. He pointed out that although cadavers don't have rights, their family members do. I could imagine some sort of lawsuit that is based upon emotional distress. You get some of those cases in a cemetery situation where the proprietor has allowed the coffins to rot away and the corpses pop up. I replied that as long as you have informed consent, a signed agreement from the donor stating that he has willed his body to medical research, it would seem that the survivors wouldn't have much of a case. The sticking point is the word informed. It's fair to say that when people donate remains, either their own or those of a family member, they usually don't care to know the grisly details of what might be done with them. And that if you did tell them the details, they might change their minds and withdraw consent. Then again, if you're planning to shoot guns at them, it might be good to run that up the flagpole and get the A-OK. Part of respecting persons is telling them the information that they might have an emotional response to, says Edmund Howe, editor of the Journal of Clinical Ethics, who reviewed Marlene DeMaio's research proposal. Though one could go the other way and spare them that response, and therefore ethically not commit that harm, but the downside to withholding information that might be significant to them is that it would violate their dignity to an extent. Howe suggests a third possibility, that of letting the families make the choice. Would they prefer to hear the specifics of what is being done with the donated body, specifics that may be upsetting, or would they prefer not to know? It's a delicate balance that, in the end, comes down to wording. Observes Baker, you don't really want to be telling somebody, well, what we'll be doing is dissecting their eyeballs. We take them out and put them on a table, and then we dissect them into finer and finer parts, and then once we're finished, we scrape all that stuff up and put it into a biohazard bag and try to keep it together so we can return whatever's left to you. That sounds horrible. On the other hand, medical research is a tad vague. Instead, you say, one of our principal concerns here at the university is ophthalmology. So we do a lot here with ophthalmological materials. If someone cares to think it through, it isn't hard to come to the conclusion that someone in a lab coat will, at the very least, be cutting your eyeballs out of your head. But most people don't care to think it through. They focus on the end rather than the means. Someone's vision may one day be saved. Ballistic studies are especially problematic. How do you decide it's okay to cut off someone's grandfather's head and shoot it in the face? Even when the reason you are doing that is to gather data to ensure that innocent civilians who are hit in the face with non-lethal bullets won't suffer disfiguring fractures. Moreover, how do you bring yourself to carry out the cutting off and shooting of someone's grandfather's head? I posed these questions to Cindy Burr, who brought herself to do exactly that, and whom I met while I was at Wayne State. Burr is accustomed to firing projectiles at the dead. In 1993, the National Institute of Justice, NIJ, commissioned her to document the impact effects of various non-lethal munitions, plastic bullets, rubber ones, beanbags, the lot. Police began using non-lethal bullets in the late 1980s in situations where they need to subdue civilians, mostly rioters and violent psychotics, without putting their lives in danger. In 9 instances since that time, non-lethal bullets have proved lethal, prompting the NIJ to have Burr look into what was going on with these different bullets, with the aim of its not going on ever again. As to the question, how do you bring yourself to cut off someone's grandfather's head, Burr replied, "Thankfully, Ruin does that for us." The very same Ruin who preps the cadavers for automotive impacts. She added that the non-lethal munitions were not shot from guns but fired from air cannons, because doing so is both more precise and less disturbing. "Still," concedes Burr, "I was glad when that one finished up." Burr copes, like most other cadaver researchers do, with a mix of compassion and emotional remove. You treat them with dignity, and you kind of separate the fact that, I don't want to say that they're not a person, but you think of them as a specimen. Burr was trained as a nurse, and in some ways finds the dead easier to work with. I know they can't feel it, and I know that I'm not going to hurt them. Even the most practiced cadaver researcher has days when the task at hand presents itself as something other than scientific method. For Burr, it had little to do with the fact that she was directing bullets at her subjects. It is the moments when the specimen steps out of his anonymity, his objecthood, and into his past experience as a human being. We received a specimen, and I went down to help Ruin, and this gentleman must have come directly from the nursing home or hospital, she recalls. He had on a T-shirt and flannel PJ pants. It hit me like, this could be my dad. Then there was one that I went to look at. A lot of times you like to take a look at the specimen to make sure it's not too big to lift. And this person was wearing a hospital gown from my hometown. If you really want to stay up late worrying about lawsuits and bad publicity, explode a bomb near the body of someone who has willed his remains to science. This is perhaps the most firmly entrenched taboo of the cadaveric research world. Indeed, live anesthetized animals have generally been considered preferable as targets of explosions to dead human beings. In a 1968 Defense Atomic Support Agency paper entitled Estimates of Man's Tolerance to the Direct Effects of Air Blast, i.e. from bombs, researchers discussed the effects of experimental explosions upon mice, hamsters, rats, guinea pigs, rabbits, cats, dogs, goats, sheep, steers, pigs, burros, and stump-tailed macaques, but not upon the actual subject of inquiry. No one had ever strapped a cadaver up against the shock tube to see what might happen. I called up a man named Aris Makris, who works for a company in Canada called MedEng Systems, which engineers protective gear for people who clear landmines. I told him about the DASA paper. Dr. Makris explained that dead people weren't always the best models for gauging living people's tolerance to explosive blasts because of their lungs, which are deflated and not doing the things that lungs normally do. The shock wave from a bomb wreaks the most havoc on the body's most easily compressed tissue, and that is found in the lungs, specifically the tiny, delicate air sacs where the blood picks up oxygen and drops off carbon dioxide. An explosive shock wave compresses and ruptures these sacs. Blood then seeps into the lungs and drowns their owner, sometimes quickly, in 10 or 20 minutes, sometimes over a span of hours. Makris conceded that, biomedical issues aside, the blast tolerance chaps were probably not highly motivated to work with cadavers. There are enormous ethical or PR challenges with that, he said. It just hasn't been the habit of blasting cadavers. Please give your body to science so we can blow it up. One group recently braved the storm. Lieutenant Colonel Robert Harris and a team of other doctors from the Extremity Trauma Study Branch at the U.S. Army Institute of Surgical Research at Fort Sam Houston, Texas, recruited cadavers to test 5 types of footwear, either commonly used by or being newly marketed for landmine clearance teams. Ever since the Vietnam War, a rumor had persisted that sandals were the safest footwear for landmine clearance, for they minimized injuries caused by fragments of the footwear itself being driven into the foot like shrapnel, compounding the damage and the risk of infection. Yet no one had ever tested the sandal claim on a real foot, nor had anyone done cadaver tests of any of the equipment being touted by manufacturers as offering greater safety than the standard combat boot. Enter the fearless men of the Lower Extremity Assessment Program. Started in 1999, 20 cadavers from a Dallas Medical School wheeled body program were strapped one by one into a harness hanging from the ceiling of a portable blast shelter. Each cadaver was outfitted with strain gauges and load cells in its heel and ankle and clad in one of six types of footwear. Some boots claim to protect by raising the foot up away from the blast, whose forces attenuate quickly. Others claim to protect by absorbing or deflecting the blast's energy. The bodies were posed in standard walking position, heel to the ground, as though striding confidently to their doom. As an added note of verisimilitude, each cadaver was outfitted head to toe in a regulation battle dress uniform. In addition to the added realism, the uniforms conferred a measure of respect, the sort of respect that a powder blue leotard might not, in the eyes of the U.S. Army anyway, supply. Harris felt confident that the study's humanitarian benefits outweighed any potential breach of dignity. Nonetheless, he consulted the Willed Body Program administrators about the possibility of informing family members about the specifics of the test. They advised against it, both because of what they called the revisiting of grief among families who had made peace with the decision to donate, and because when you get down to the nitty-gritty details of an experiment, virtually any use of a cadaver is potentially upsetting. If Willed Body Program coordinators contacted the families of LEAP cadavers, would they then have to contact the families of the leg drop test cadavers down the hall, or for that matter, the anatomy lab cadavers across campus? As Harris points out, the difference between a blast test and an anatomy class dissection is essentially the time span. One lasts a fraction of a second, the other lasts a year. In the end, he says, they look pretty much the same. I asked Harris if he plans to donate his body to research. He sounded downright keen on the prospect. I'm always saying, after I die, just put me out there and blow me up. If Harris could have done his research using surrogate dummy legs instead of cadavers, he would have done so. Today, there are a couple good ones in the works developed by the Australian Defence Science and Technology Organization. In Australia, as in other Commonwealth nations, ballistics and blast testing on human cadavers is not allowed, and certain words are spelled funny. The frangible surrogate leg, FSL, is made of materials that react to blast similarly to the way human leg materials do. It has mineralized plastic for bones, for example, and ballistic gelatin for muscle. In March of 2001, Harris exposed the Australian leg to the same landmine blasts that his cadavers had weathered to see if the results correlated. Disappointingly, the bone fracture patterns were somewhat off. The main problem at the moment is cost. Each FSL, they aren't reusable, costs around $5,000. The cost of a cadaver, to cover shipping, HIV and hepatitis C testing, cremation, etc., is typically under $500. Harris imagines it's only a matter of time before the kinks are worked out and the price comes down. He looks forward to that time. Surrogates are preferable not only because tests involving landmines and cadavers are ethically and probably literally sticky, but because cadavers aren't uniform. The older they are, the thinner their bones and the less elastic their tissue. In the case of landmine work, the ages are an especially poor match, with the average landmine clearer in his 20s and the average donated cadaver in its 60s. It's like market testing Kid Rock singles on a room full of Perry Como fans. Until that time, it'll be rough going for Commonwealth landmine types who cannot use whole cadavers. Researchers in the UK have resorted to testing boots on amputated legs, a much criticized practice, owing to the fact that these limbs have typically had gangrene or diabetic complications that render them poor mimics of healthy limbs. Another group tried putting a new type of protective boot onto the hind leg of a mule deer for testing. Given that deer lack toes and heels, and people lack hooves, and that no country I know of employs mule deer in landmine clearance, it is hard, though mildly entertaining, to try to imagine what the value of such a study could have been. LEAP, for its part, turned out to be a valuable study. The sandal myth was mildly vindicated. The injuries were about as severe as they were with a combat boot. And one boot, Med Eng's spider boot, showed itself to be a solid improvement over standard issue footwear, though a larger sample is needed to be sure. Harris considers the project a success, because with landmines, even a small gain in protection can mean a huge difference in a victim's medical outcome. If I can save a foot or keep an amputation below the knee, he says, that's a win. It is an unfortunate given of human trauma research that the things most likely to accidentally maim or kill people, things we most need to study and understand, are also the things most likely to mutilate research cadavers. Car crashes, gunshots, explosions, sporting accidents. There is no need to use cadavers to study stapler injuries or human tolerance to ill-fitting footwear. In order to be able to protect against a threat, whether it is automotive or a bomb, observes Makris, you have to put the human to its limits. You've got to get destructive. I agree with Dr. Makris. Does this mean I would let someone blow up my dead foot to help save the feet of NATO landmine clearers? It does. And would I let someone shoot my dead face with a non-lethal projectile to help prevent accidental fatalities? I suppose I would. What wouldn't I let someone do to my remains? I can think of only one experiment I know of that, were I a cadaver, I wouldn't want anything to do with. This particular experiment wasn't done in the name of science or education or safer cars or better protected soldiers. It was done in the name of religion. Chapter 7, Holy Cadaver, the Crucifixion Experiments. The year was 1931. French doctors and medical students were gathered in Paris for an annual affair called the Lenec Conference. Late one morning, a priest appeared on the fringes of the gathering. He wore the long black cassock and Roman collar of the Catholic Church, and he carried a worn leather portfolio beneath one arm. His name was Father Amilac, he said, and he sought the counsel of France's finest anatomists. Inside the portfolio was a series of close-up photographs of the Shroud of Turin, the linen cloth in which believers held Jesus had been wrapped for burial when he was taken down from the cross. The Shroud's authenticity was in question then, as now, and the Church had turned to medicine to see if the markings corresponded to the realities of anatomy and physiology. Dr. Pierre Barbet, a prominent and none too humble surgeon, invited Father Amilac to his office at Hospital Saint Joseph and swiftly nominated himself for the job. "I am well versed in anatomy, which I taught for a long time," he recalls telling Amilac in A Doctor at Cavalry, The Passion of Our Lord Jesus Christ, as described by a surgeon. "I lived for 13 years in close contact with corpses," reads the next line. One assumes that the teaching stint and the years spent living in close contact with corpses were one and the same, but who knows? Perhaps he kept dead family members in the cellar. The French have been known to do that. Little is known about our Dr. Barbet, except that he became very devoted, possibly a little too devoted, to proving the authenticity of the Shroud. One day soon he would find himself up in his lab, pounding nails into the hands and feet of an elfin, Einstein-haired cadaver, one of the many unclaimed dead brought as a matter of course to Parisian anatomy labs, and crucifying the dead man on a cross of his own making. Barbet had become fixated on a pair of elongated blood stains issuing from the imprint on the back of the right hand of the Shroud. The two stains come from the same source but proceed along different paths at different angles. "The first," he writes, "mounts obliquely upwards and inwards. Anatomically, its position is like that of a soldier when challenging, reaching the ulnar edge of the forearm. Another flow, but one more slender and meandering, has gone upwards as far as the elbow." In the soldier remark, we have an early glimmer of what, in the due course of time, became clear. Barbet was something of a whack. I mean, I don't wish to be unkind, but who uses battle imagery to describe the angle of a blood flow? Barbet decided that the two flows were created by Jesus alternately pushing himself up and then sagging down to hang by his hands. Thus, the trickle of blood from the nail wound would follow two different paths, depending on which position he was in. The reason Jesus was doing this, Barbet theorized, was that when people hang from their arms, it becomes difficult to exhale. Jesus was trying to keep from suffocating. Then, after a while, his legs would fatigue and he'd sag back down again. Barbet cited as support for his idea a torture technique used during World War I, wherein the victim is hung by his hands, which are bound together over his head. Hanging by the hands causes a variety of cramps and contractions, wrote Barbet. Eventually, these reach the inspiratory muscles and prevent expiration. The condemned men, being unable to empty their lungs, die of asphyxia. Barbet used the angles of the purported blood flows on the shroud to calculate what Jesus's two positions on the cross must have been. In the sagging posture, he calculated that the outstretched arms formed a 65-degree angle with the stipes, the upright beam, of the cross. In the pushed-up position, the arms formed a 70-degree angle with the stipes. Barbet then tried to verify this using one of the many unclaimed corpses that were delivered to the anatomy department from the city's hospitals and poorhouses. Once Barbet got the body back to his lab, he proceeded to nail it to a homemade cross. He then raised the cross upright and measured the angle of the arms when the slumping body came to a stop. Lo and behold, it was 65 degrees. As the cadaver could, of course, not be persuaded to push itself back up, the second angle remained unverified. The French edition of Barbet's book includes a photograph of the dead man on the cross. The cadaver is shown from the waist up, so I cannot say whether Barbet dressed him Jesus-style in swaddling undergarments, but I can say that he bears an uncanny resemblance to the monologuist Spalding Gray. Barbet's idea presented an anatomical conundrum. For if there were periods when Jesus' legs gave out and he was forced to hang the entire weight of his body off his nailed palms, wouldn't the nails rip through the flesh? Barbet wondered whether, in fact, Jesus had been nailed through the stronger, bonier wrists and not the flesh of the palms. He decided to do an experiment, detailed in A Doctor at Cavalry. This time, rather than wrestle another whole cadaver onto his cross, he crucified a lone arm. Barely had the owner of the arm left the room when Barbet had his hammer out. Having just amputated an arm two-thirds of the way up from a vigorous man, I drove a square nail of about one-third of an inch, the nail of the passion, into the middle of the palm. I gently suspended a weight of 100 pounds from the elbow, half the weight of the body of a man about 6 foot tall. After 10 minutes, the wound had lengthened. I then gave the hole a moderate shake, and I saw the nail suddenly forcing its way through the space between the two metacarpal heads and making a large tear in the skin. A second slight shake tore away what skin remained. In the weeks that followed, Barbet went through 12 more arms in a quest to find a suitable point in the human wrist through which to hammer a 1/3-inch nail. This was not a good time for vigorous men with minor hand injuries to visit the offices of Dr. Pierre Barbet. Eventually, Barbet's busy hammer made its way to what he believed was the true site of the nail's passage, Destot's space, a pea-sized gap between the two rows of the bones of the wrist. "In each case," he wrote, "the point took up its own direction and seemed to be slipping along the walls of a funnel, and then to find its way spontaneously into the space which was awaiting it. It was as though divine intervention applied to nail trajectories as well. And this spot," Barbet continued triumphantly, "is precisely where the shroud shows us the mark of the nail, a spot of which no forger would have had any idea." And then along came Frederick Zugib. Zugib is a gruff, overworked medical examiner for Rockland County, New York, who spends his spare time researching the crucifixion and Barbet bashing at what he calls shroudy conferences around the world. He'll always make time to talk to you if you call, but it becomes quickly clear in the course of the conversation that spare time is something Zugib has very little of. He'll be halfway through an explanation of the formula used to determine the pull of the body on each of Christ's hands when his voice will wander away from the telephone for a minute, and then he'll come back and say, "Excuse me, a 9-year-old body. Father beat her to death. Where were we?" Zugib is not on a mission to prove the authenticity of the Shroud of Turin, as I suspect Barbet was. He became interested in the science of crucifixion 50 years ago as a biology student when someone gave him a paper to read about the medical aspects of the crucifixion. The physiological information in the paper struck him as inaccurate, so I researched it out, wrote a term paper, and got interested. The Shroud of Turin interested him only in that it might, were it for real, provide a great deal of information about the physiology of crucifixion. Then I came across Barbet. I thought, gee, this is exciting. Must be a real smart guy, double blood flow and all that. Zugib began doing research of his own. One by one, Barbet's theories fell apart. Like Barbet, Zugib constructed a cross, which has stood, with the exception of several days during 2001 when it was out for repairs, warped stipes, in his garage in suburban New York for some 40 years. Rather than crucifying corpses, Barbet uses live volunteers, hundreds in all. For his first study, he recruited just shy of 100 volunteers from a local religious group, the Third Order of St. Francis. How much do you have to pay a research subject to be crucified? Nothing. They would have paid me, says Zugib. Everyone wants to go up and see what it felt like. Granted, Zugib was using leather straps, not nails. Over the years, Zugib has occasionally received calls from volunteers seeking the real deal. Would you believe? A girl called me and wanted me to actually nail her. She's with this group where they put plates in their face. They surgically alter their heads. They bifurcate their tongues and put those things through their penis. The first thing Zugib noticed when he began putting people up on his cross was that none of them were having trouble breathing, even when they stayed up there for 45 minutes. He'd been skeptical about Barbet's suffocation theory and dismissive of the reference to torture victims because those men's hands were directly over their heads, not out to their sides. Nor did Zugib's subjects spontaneously try to lift themselves up. In fact, when asked to do so in a different experiment, they were unable to. It is totally impossible to lift yourself up from that position with the feet flush to the cross, Zugib asserts. Furthermore, he points out, the double blood flows were on the back of the hand, which was pressed against the cross. If Jesus had been pushing himself up and down, the blood oozing from the wound would have been smeared, not neatly split into two flows. What, then, could have caused the famed double flow marks on the shroud? Zugib imagines it's having happened after Jesus was taken down from the cross and washed. The washing disturbed the clotting, and a small quantity of blood trickled out and split into two rivulets as it encountered the ulnar styloid protuberance, the bump that protrudes from the pinky side of the wrist. Zugib recalled having seen a flow of blood just like this on a gunshot victim in his lab. He tested his theory by washing the dried blood from the wound of a recently arrived corpse in his lab to see if a small quantity of blood might leak out. Within a few minutes, he writes in an article published in the Shroudy journal, Sindon, a small rivulet of blood appeared. Zugib then noticed that Barbet had made an anatomical blunder regarding Destot's space, which is not, as Barbet crowed in his book, precisely where the shroud shows us the mark of the nail. The wound on the back of the hand of the Shroud of Turin appears on the thumb side of the wrist, and any anatomy textbook will confirm that Destot's space is on the pinky side of the wrist, where Barbet indeed sank his nails into his cadaver wrists. Zugib's theory holds that the nail went in through Jesus's palm at an angle and came out the backside at the wrist. He has his own brand of cadaveric experience, photographs taken 44 years ago of a murder victim that showed up in his lab. She'd been brutally stabbed over her whole body, Zugib recalls. I found a defense wound where she had raised her hand in an attempt to protect her face from the vicious onslaught. Though the entry wound was in the palm, the knife had apparently traveled at an angle, coming out the back of the wrist on the thumb side. The pathway of the knife apparently offered little resistance. An X-ray showed no chipped bones. There is a photograph of Zugib and one of his volunteers in the aforementioned Sindon article. Zugib is dressed in a knee-length white lab coat and is shown adjusting one of the vital sign leads affixed to the man's chest. The cross reaches almost to the ceiling, towering over Zugib and his bank of medical monitors. The volunteer is naked except for a pair of gym shorts and a hearty mustache. He wears the unconcerned, mildly zoned-out expression of a person waiting at a bus stop. Neither man appears to have been self-conscious about being photographed this way. I think that when you get yourself deep down into a project like this, you lose sight of how odd you must appear to the rest of the world. No doubt Pierre Barbet saw nothing strange or wrong in using cadavers meant for the teaching of anatomy as subjects in a simulated crucifixion to prove to doubters that the miraculous Shroud of Turin was for real. "It is indeed essential," he wrote in the introduction to A Doctor at Cavalry, "that we who are doctors, anatomists, and physiologists, that we who know should proclaim abroad the terrible truth that our poor science should no longer be used merely to alleviate the pains of our brothers, but should fulfill a greater office, that of enlightening them." To my mind, there is no greater office than that of alleviating the pains of our brothers, certainly not the office of religious propaganda. Some people, as we're about to see, manage to alleviate their brothers' pains and sufferings while utterly dead. If there were ever a cadaver eligible for sainthood, it would not be our Spalding Gray upon the cross. It would be these guys, the brain dead, beating heart organ donors that come and go in our hospitals every day. Chapter 8. How to Know If You're Dead. Beating heart cadavers, live burial, and the scientific search for the soul. A patient on the way to surgery travels at twice the speed of a patient on the way to the morgue. Gurneys that ferry the living through hospital corridors move forward in an aura of purpose and push, flanked by caregivers with long strides and set faces, steadying IVs, pumping ambubags, barreling into double doors. A gurney with a cadaver commands no urgency. It is wheeled by a single person, calmly and with little notice, like a shopping cart. For this reason, I thought I would be able to tell when the dead woman was wheeled past. I have been standing around at the nurse's station on one of the surgery floors at the University of California at San Francisco Medical Center, watching gurneys go by and waiting for Von Peterson, public affairs manager of the California Transplant Donor Network, and a cadaver I will call H. "There's your patient," says the charge nurse. A commotion of turquoise legs passes with unexpected forward-leaning urgency. H is unique in that she is both a dead person and a patient on the way to surgery. She is what's known as a beating heart cadaver, alive and well everywhere but her brain. Up until artificial respiration was developed, there was no such entity. Without a functioning brain, a body will not breathe on its own. But hook it up to a respirator, and its heart will beat, and the rest of its organs will, for a matter of days, continue to thrive. H doesn't look or smell or feel dead. If you leaned in close over the gurney, you could see her pulse beating in the arteries of her neck. If you touched her arm, you would find it warm and resilient, like your own. This is perhaps why the nurses and doctors refer to H as a patient, and why she makes her entrance to the OR at the customary pre-surgery clip. Since brain death is the legal definition of death in this country, H, the person, is certifiably dead, but H, the organs and tissues, is very much alive. These two seemingly contradictory facts afford her an opportunity most corpses do not have, that of extending the lives of two or three dying strangers. Over the next 4 hours, H will surrender her liver, kidneys, and heart. One at a time, surgeons will come and go, taking an organ and returning in haste to their stricken patients. Until recently, the process was known among transplant professionals as an organ harvest, which had a joyous, celebratory ring to it, perhaps a little too joyous, as it has been of late replaced by the more businesslike organ recovery. In H's case, one surgeon will be traveling from Utah to recover her heart, and another, the one recovering both the liver and the kidneys, will be taking them two floors down. UCSF is a major transplant center, and organs removed here often remain in-house. More typically, a transplant patient's surgeon will travel from UCSF to a small town somewhere to retrieve the organ, often from an accident victim, someone young with strong, healthy organs whose brain took an unexpected hit. The doctor does this because typically there is no doctor in that small town with experience in organ recovery. Contrary to rumors about surgically trained thugs cutting people open in hotel rooms and stealing their kidneys, organ recovery is tricky work. If you want to be sure it's done right, you get on a plane and go do it yourself. Today's abdominal recovery surgeon is named Andy Posselt. He is holding an electric cauterizing wand, which looks like a cheap bank pen on a cord, but functions like a scalpel. The wand both cuts and burns, so that as the incision is made, any vessels that are severed are simultaneously melted shut. The result is that there's a good deal less bleeding and a good deal more smoke and smell. It's not a bad smell, but simply a seared meat sort of smell. I want to ask Dr. Posselt whether he likes it, but I can't bring myself to. So instead I ask whether he thinks it's bad that I like the smell, which I don't really, or maybe just a little. He replies that it is neither bad nor good, just morbid. I've never before seen major surgery, only its scars. From the length of them, I had imagined surgeons doing their business taking things out and putting them in through an opening maybe 8 or 9 inches long, like a woman poking around for her glasses at the bottom of her purse. Dr. Posselt begins just above H's pubic hair and proceeds a good 2 feet north to the base of her neck. He's unzipping her like a parka. Her sternum is sawed lengthwise so that her rib cage can be parted, and a large retractor is installed to pull the two sides of the incision apart so that it is now as wide as it is long. To see her this way, held open like a Gladstone bag, forces a view of the human torso for what it basically is, a large, sturdy container for guts. On the inside, H looks very much alive. You can see the pulse of her heartbeat and her liver and all the way down her aorta. She bleeds where she is cut, and her organs are plump and slippery-looking. The electronic beat of the heart monitor reinforces the impression that this is a living, breathing, thriving person. It is strange, almost impossible, really, to think of her as a corpse. When I tried to explain beating heart cadavers to my stepdaughter Phoebe yesterday, it didn't make sense to her. But if their heart is beating, aren't they still a person? She wanted to know. In the end, she decided they were a kind of person you could play tricks on, but they wouldn't know, which I think is a pretty good way of summing up most donated cadavers. The things that happen to the dead in labs and ORs are like gossip passed behind one's back. They are not felt or known, and so they cause no pain. The contradictions and counterintuitions of the beating heart cadaver can exact an emotional toll on the intensive care unit, ICU staff, who must, in the days preceding the harvest, not only think of patients like H as living beings, but treat and care for them that way as well. The cadaver must be monitored around the clock and life-saving interventions undertaken on its behalf. Since the brain can no longer regulate blood pressure or the levels of hormones and their release into the bloodstream, these things must be done by ICU staff in order to keep the organs from degrading. Observed a group of Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine physicians in a New England Journal of Medicine article entitled "Psychosocial and Ethical Implications of Organ Retrieval." Intensive care unit personnel may feel confused about having to perform cardiopulmonary resuscitation on a patient who has been declared dead, whereas a "do not resuscitate" order has been written for a living patient in the next bed. The confusion people feel over beating heart cadavers reflects centuries of confusion over how exactly to define death, to pinpoint the precise moment when the spirit, the soul, the chi, whatever you wish to call it, has ceased to exist and all that remains is a corpse. Before brain activity could be measured, the stopping of the heart had long been considered the defining moment. In point of fact, the brain survives for 6 to 10 minutes after the heart has stopped pumping blood to it, but this is splitting hairs, and the definition works quite well for the most part. The problem for centuries was that doctors couldn't tell for sure whether the heart had ceased to beat or whether they were merely having trouble hearing it. The stethoscope wasn't invented until the mid-1800s, and the early models amounted to little more than a sort of medical ear trumpet. In cases where the heartbeat and pulse are especially faint, drowning, stroke, certain types of narcotic poisoning, even the most scrupulous physician had difficulty telling, and patients ran the risk of being dispatched to the undertaker before they'd actually expired. To allay patients' considerable fears of live burial, as well as their own insecurities, 18th and 19th century physicians devised a diverting roster of methods for verifying death. Welsh physician and medical historian Jan Bondesen collected dozens of them for his witty and admirably researched book, Buried Alive. The techniques seemed to fall into two categories, those that purported to rouse the unconscious patients with unspeakable pain, and those that threw in a measure of humiliation. The soles of the feet were sliced with razors, and needles jammed beneath toenails. Ears were assaulted with bugle fanfares and hideous shrieks and excessive noises. One French clergyman recommended thrusting a red-hot poker up what Bondesen genteelly refers to as the rear passage. A French physician invented a set of nipple pinchers specifically for the purpose of reanimation. Another invented a bagpipe-like contraption for administering tobacco enemas, which he demonstrated enthusiastically on cadavers in the morgues of Paris. The 17th-century anatomist Jacob Winslow entreated his colleagues to pour boiling Spanish wax on patients' foreheads and warm urine into their mouths. One Swedish tract on the matter suggested that a crawling insect be put into the corpse's ear. For simplicity and originality, though, nothing quite matches the thrusting of a sharp pencil up the presumed cadaver's nose. In some cases, it is unclear who was the more humiliated, patient or doctor. French physician Jean-Baptiste Vincent Laborde wrote at great length of his technique of rhythmic tongue-pulling, which was to be carried out for no less than 3 hours following the suspected death. He later invented a hand-cranked tongue-pulling machine, which made the task less unpleasant, though only marginally less tedious. Another French physician instructed doctors to stick one of the patient's fingers in their ear to listen for the buzzing sound produced by involuntary muscle movement. Not all that surprisingly, none of these techniques gained wide acceptance, and most doctors felt that putrefaction was the only reliable way to verify that someone was dead. This meant that corpses had to sit around the house or the doctor's office for 2 or 3 days until the telltale signs and smells could be detected, a prospect perhaps even less appealing than giving them enemas. And so it was that special buildings called waiting mortuaries were built for the purpose of warehousing the moldering dead. These were huge, ornate halls, common in Germany in the 1800s. Some had separate halls for male and female cadavers, as though even in death men couldn't be trusted to comport themselves respectably in the presence of a lady. Others were segregated by class, with the well-to-do deceased paying extra to rot in luxury surroundings. Attendants were employed to keep watch for signs of life, which they did via a system of strings linking the fingers of corpses to a bell, or in one case, the bellows of a large organ, so that any motion on the part of the deceased would alert the attendant, who was posted owing to the considerable